Well, I'm not entirely sort of knowledgeable about this subject. I'm first just asking about the myths that the Nazis used to perpetuate racism. Well, of course, the basic myth was racial inferiority. I mean, it was a genetic argument. But of course, if we look at groups today who would be termed as Nazis, perhaps not Nazis, but fascists, like, say, the National Front or groups like that. I mean, the main thing about groups like this is that they emphasise, rather than emphasising as a factor which unites people, rather than emphasising class and the fact that we're all in the same class position, they emphasise state. For them, state is the thing which people should give their primary allegiance to, and state overrides any class considerations. And, of course, this is a very dangerous myth, because in fact workers have got nothing, as you probably know, have got nothing to be grateful to the state for whatsoever. I mean, the state is basically an oppressive tool which the owning class use, which the property owners use in their own interests to repress the majority of workers, or not necessarily with overt oppression, but just by the threat of prison, by the threat of prison and incarceration, whatever. Anyway, this is a very dangerous myth, but in the alienated society in which we live, and I would argue that we do live in an alienated society, people who don't recognise or who aren't prepared to admit that they have a common cause or an affinity with another worker can be easily swayed. I mean, when people are reaching for some sort of identity and something to belong to, some of the arguments and some of the... I mean, you've got to be very careful. Some of the arguments and some of the propaganda of these sort of fascist-type organisations like the National Front and the British Movement, etc., can be very persuasive. And we've got to be prepared to argue always that the basic thing which unites people is their class interests, our common interests as workers, as people who are exploited by another class, and not any fictitious sort of affinity, and what's supposed to be some sort of umbilical cord or something to the state. I don't know if anybody else wants to expand on that point. Sure.
Yeah. Yeah, my question is also about fascism, particularly in the during the downturn in the 70s, we saw the National Front start marching for the back. There's a lot of sort of practical steps the SPD being taught to counteract.
Dr.
Steps. I don't really know what practical steps the SPGB took to counteract them. One thing that we did do, in the Socialist Party, we tend to believe that the most powerful weapon that we have, or the most powerful weapon that we and other members of the working class have on our side, is our ability to be rational and our ability to persuade other people of their common interests as workers. We think that that's more powerful, much more powerful and much more frightening to the capitalist class or any fascist party than sort of getting involved in a scrap in the street. I don't know what else. I mean, perhaps somebody else has got information on this. The Socialist Party did at that time. But one thing they did do was hold a meeting. We actually held a meeting to talk about fascist ideas, to try and discredit fascist ideas. I think we held a debate with one of the fascist groups, and tried to publicly, on a platform, discredit their ideas in front of an audience, which I think is probably the most powerful thing that you can do to stem fascism, to actually show people in argument what a load of groundless rubbish it is, to decimate their ideas. That's one thing I know that the Socialist Party did around that time. I don't know if anybody else knows anything about it.
Could you explain to me the reason why workers emigrate from one country to another?
The reasons why workers emigrate from one country to another? I wouldn't know. I mean, obviously there are lots of personal reasons that people have for emigration from one country to another. usually, well, I can only speak for the people that I've talked to who've emigrated, and it's to find a better life, basically, better working conditions, better living conditions, to find a way out of what's usually an economic depression in their country and go somewhere that they see as a booming economy. Would you agree with that?
At the back.
Yeah, she did. Yeah. I did a speech for a Pokemon recently where a guy came on the piece called Derek Beats of the Rapson and was saying, it's interesting with what's been going on last week where we've had Jesse Jackson on the TV and given out some sort of very sort of I know that sort of my own personal thing, a lot of racism is institutionalized. People who aren't white who are born in this country come up through a system that they can turn their shit. And part of the reaction is for example, this is what I don't believe is what I'm saying. My mother always told me that I should have positive black kids to look up to. And you know, you might be one of these kids might be something like that. Might be something like Jesse Jackson. I just want to speak the talk of people who are saying within racism, well, the only way you can combat racism, you could turn around and say, you know, the only way you're going to have a positive way of looking at life is finding people of your own colour who you can stand up to, or who you can say are positive and sort of believe in. So I have an idea what you might say now, but I just wonder how you sort of answer that when people say, well, I'm so sort of pissed off with this sort of society. Nobody's offered the role model to take them through or something like that. Or where they're saying, there's nothing, you know, nobody's offered me anything. I'm feeling like shit if I have to look for some sort of something standing on high to stand up to them. What was all that?
I think that's a really good question. Basically, for instance, I'll try and speak from my own experience. I mean, as a woman in this society, it might be argued that I would gain strength from seeing sort of positive images of women, you know, sort of having some sort of role model. But I think that's true to some extent. But they're not. I mean, they're not just any women. They're not Margaret Thatcher, for instance. I mean, obviously. So I think these ideas get confused. I mean, you mentioned two things, really. You mentioned role models and having a positive image, right, to look up to. But you also mentioned leadership. Now, to me, the two things, having something positive to identify with and actually being so insecure or having your self-image so debased, which by the way is true for the majority of workers, black, white men and women in this country, you know, their self-image is absolutely bloody debased, they've got no self-confidence whatsoever. It's a different thing, you know, the positive role model, you know, like I would look at another socialist as a positive role model. But I mean, I wouldn't look for a leader, and I think when ideas of leadership and sort of, you know, strong leadership, strong leaders tend to produce and perpetuate weak followers. So then the equation doesn't work because you don't get strong leaders producing strong followers, if you see what I mean. I mean, that's a little confused, but those are my general feelings about that.
First of all, on the question of role models to look up at, Jesse Jackson is performing a great service to the American capitalist classes. Jesse Jackson made a speech a couple of nights ago in Atlanta, Georgia, where he said, if you want something in this society, anyone can have it. Well, incidentally, that is some of the most prosperous quarter that you can't have it if you're a worker. You won't bloody get it. That's number one. So I don't want role model. I don't want a role model to look across at. I don't actually see why you have role models to look up at. don't actually want to look up at anything. I might look up in the sky and see if it's raining. I don't want a role model to look up at. That's the workers have been looking up for a little bit too long, so I can skip that one. Secondly, see, I think this whole thing, black and white, is a nonsensical term, as you said. We're talking about workers and capitalists, but you know, I mean, I've never seen a black person. And I think that the whole notion of black people is a racist notion, and it's a product of a kind of a duality that we present in this society. What are you, black or white? What are you, you know, everybody has got to be one or the other. Now, as far as I'm concerned, you know, the only white person I've ever seen, you know, I was once shopping in Sainsbury's and a woman had a heart attack and died right next to me, you know, literally on my hand, she was white. But, you know, this is not a human phenomenon. I'm not white, and I'm not black. And frankly, you know, I've got better things to do with my time than to look at people's skin pigmentation. And of course, the issue isn't about people's skin pigmentation. It's about people who are poor or people who are rich. I mean, you get people saying, there's a black person moved next door to me. You know, they're not going to say, oh, you know, bad news, Diana Ross has just moved next door to me. Because the fact is, she's not going to move into an area where they're living. They're not going to say, you know, Johnny Mathis has just bought counties. This is bad news. It's not, they're not living in those sort of areas. Now, the point I wanted to really come to was, our friend over there asked the question, how does socialists respond to fascists? You know, well, how does socialists respond to racists when the National Front were marching through the gutters? I must say, when the National Front were marching through the gutters, I couldn't think of a better bloody place for the National Front to march, incidentally, than in the gutter. But he then says, well, what do you do to deal with racism? Well, look, there are three options as far as I'm concerned. Option number one, which is incidentally what the majority of people on the left did, is that you sit around in Labour Party branches, where most people on the left are, and most left groups tell people to vote for it, and you say, isn't racism a terrible thing? Racism is really bad. It's really inhumane. And you come up with a lot of old liberal, sentimental crap about how everybody should be nice to each other and we shouldn't have a society of racist and sexist competition and strife. The fact of the matter is, the National Front would never have existed in the 1970s if it wasn't for the appalling racism of the Labour Party in power, which, having first of all brought in the first ever immigration, obviously, you can't bring in the first ever Immigration Act, which determined whether people can come into a country on the basis of their skin colour, without, as a result of that, creating a situation where you get further racism. And most of the people who joined the National Front, be quite clear about it, didn't come out of the Tory party. It's quite frankly, if you're in the Tory party, you don't need to leave it to become racist. The people who joined the National Front came out of the Labour Party. And the Labour Party themselves acknowledges the problem. The National Front was a working class movement of kids, largely young people, not all looking young, not on the whole very well politically educated, which is a usual symptom of being a member of the Labour Party, who, as a result of their position, were not able to get anything at all. They looked at Callaghan, they looked at Wilson, and people like that, and they said, if that's the only alternative, democracy doesn't work, the whole system doesn't work, and just like workers under the Weimar Republic, they start turning to bureaucrats, although I can't find a more ridiculous looking and sounding bureaucrat than Martin Webster, who looks like a sort of figure in a Marmite advert, but there we go. And then, what's the second option? The second option, which incidentally, I don't know which of these three options our friend who raised the question holds, is you do what was called in the 1970s, everybody heard it, you go out and you fight the fascists on the street. Now, what you've got to do is every time you see a racist, you beat them up. Well, I'll tell you something, and I was telling people this in the 1970s. If every time you see a racist, you're going to beat them up, you're going to go out the front door in the morning, every person you see walking to the station, going to work, you beat up 9 out of 10 of them. You get on the train, beat up 9 out of 10 of the people. And incidentally, if you're only going to beat up the racists who joined the National Front, then you're pretty stupid, because the racists who joined the National Front are, by and large, the most harmless ones of all. The ones who are in the National Front, by and large, were so busy indulging in their own bloody mindless fantasies that by and large, you know, they were so busy sort of fighting with each other about who was going to be Hitler and who was going to be Hitler after the big push had occurred. But they did, you know, they, by and large, you know, I don't want to understate what they did, far from it. But the National Front was an insignificant, it's a marginalised, it's a one speech for Margaret Thatcher before the 1979 election about British culture being swamped, and she pretty well won over the National Front membership into voting for the Tory Party 79. That's pretty clear. But the third thing you do with a fascist and with a racist is you educate them. Now, what happened at the Polytechnic of North London when Patrick Harrington, a self-styled fascist leader, entered into it and wanted to become a philosophy student, you know, philosophy student with a big F. Well, Patrick Harrington entered into the Polytechnic of North London, and Students' Union, controlled by those people whose tactical blunders are, you know, the tactical blunders that they have committed are, I mean, they've never even had power, they're still preparing to take power. The Socialist Workers' Party, the Trotsky, the heirs to the throne of Lenin. These people came along, and what were they quoted as saying in Newsweek and Gazette? I'll never forget the comment. They said, fascists don't deserve an education. Well, if fascists don't deserve an education, who the fuck does deserve an education? They've got contempt for their fellow workers, and they believe that if you can't educate workers, you've got to beat up workers. And if they think that, not only are you never going to get socialism, but you're going to earn yourself a hell of a lot of enemies within the working class. We as socialists have got to say, look, if a worker's racist, if a worker's sexist, if a worker is a nationalist, you've got to talk to that worker, you've got to look at why they hold those ideas, and you've got to treat it, in my view, as a kind of political psychological problem, which it is. And if anyone here has got any other argument about how you defeat racists, I'd like to hear the quick way of doing it.
Thanks for that contribution. Any more? Yep.
I was slightly disconcerted about what Nick said about the practicality of combating fascist groups. I mean, yes, they dearly held a meeting. It's very important to use rationale to win workers over to your ideas and counter the tendencies. However, what was the feeling within the SPGP about the anti-Marxist League? I know that apparently the Labour Party has thought the right-wing movements would go away, but this just gives them carte blanche to multiply. An organisation like the ANL stopped them in the streets. What was the SPGP trying to do?
Well, I think probably putting a Schnurdauer line on it, you know, people are suffering from delusions and ignorance. That, you know, they're sort of labouring under a load of myths. Then you try and disillusion them. You try to correct those myths. Obviously, you don't go around sort of like no more than I would go around and put up with somebody sort of giving me a load of sexist crap. I wouldn't go around and put up with somebody. You know, I would argue against it. Obviously, you argue against ideas, but no, you don't go and beat them up. I mean, what good is that for? Or you don't accost them. I mean. You accost them with ideas. You challenge their ideas, yeah, and you try to get through to them. But I don't think it's very fair to you because you're not sort of putting your solution sort of thing. You know what I mean? So I'm really arguing blind a bit. But I'll just repeat what's been said. You try and educate these people. You don't, and obviously people who are the butt of their sort of prejudices have to respond to that. They have to deal with that. I mean, I as a woman might have to deal with sexism, and I would deal with this, you know, in a way which I felt I was capable of at the time. I would argue against it, and I think, you know, black people suffering from racism would probably do the same thing. But what is your, we've put our solution, what's your solution?
Well, yeah, I would say that to work within trade unions to mobilise people, to hold counter demonstrations, because if something like the NF are going to make open meetings in public, then you've got to mobilise people already on the side. You've got to convince more people to hold a counter demonstration.
Well, just on that, I mean, you don't, you know, I think we're very much arguing about words here. I mean, we do hold counter demonstrations. We hold counter demonstrations every week in a place called Speakers Corner in Hyde Park, where week after week after week, people. Sorry?
It's a
bunch of
tourists there.
Well, you're a foreign worker, is it?
Can we have it through the chair, please?
I think you're wrong about that. I think the people who come, tourists who come to Hyde Park, are equally likely to sort of like see Matinati sort of marches through the streets as people who, as, I mean, it's all there's a tourist in London anyway, but never mind that. It's people who live in the areas they march through. I mean, marches don't go through residential areas, they go through the centre of cities, and that's where tourists are. And like, you know, as I said, we hold counter demonstrations every week at Hyde Park. I mean, if you want to be part of that, you can come along and be part of that. I mean, every Sunday, people argue from our platform against racism and sexism and every other myth you can think of.
Very much along the line that our friend Feynman just suggested. And the net effect of that, if you take as your standard measuring number of things are and the size of numbers, it was a one-all draw. Because on the one hand, you had the Ku Klux Klan shouting some of the stuff that was being shouted. You were surprised most of the pardon campaigners in this field. And they were being responded to by people who were chanting the American equivalent of anti-Nazi slogans. It was working on a very low level. I don't think that any indifferent listener to those, the radio report or any person on the spot, would have found anything particularly edifying in having any of their racist ideas that you get countered by slogan shouting. Unless I can be great at the city, that's my perception of what these things are. You go there, you have various banners, and you shout. Now, it's your aim. My friend says, no, perhaps you can be better than a friend behind you, the last 15 minutes. Whispering father to my head, in his response to it. I'd be interested in our friends to elaborate on what is beyond jumping slogans and mobilising, but these sort of things can do. See, a number of people explain tonight, the best possible forum for racist ideas to be exposed is an open public debate. I just make one quick reference to what's been spoken about Hyde Park. I was at a meeting a few years ago in Hyde Park, and the big group of National Frontiers, National Front supporters, came along with a Union Jack box of shorts and shouted all the slogans, and it looked very threatening, and we felt that number of people congregated down the meeting. And a small group of these thugs started explaining what they were going to do in very psychotic sort of terms, to speak what they were going to do when they got in power. Then, it got more violent, it attracted by violence built up. But their arguments were exposed in front of a group of 200-300 people, a very big meeting in my car, but I'm proud of them. And this is what happened. They started to say, well, we're going to do this because we want to defend British culture. This is what we want to do for blacks and Jews and Catholics. We want to defend British culture. What British culture? What is it? This was the way that the meeting went. They said, you know, but our heritage, our English heritage. And all the times was going on, meeting, cycle meeting, expanding. And then the speaker said to them, well, what is this particular aspect of the British heritage that was so keen to protect and to repatriate people and protect and to physically injure people to protect? So, and did you know famous British parts of our culture? And they were asked questions about Spam, the British England, Coronation Street. And said, no, that's not making it. We need serious British culture, you know, books and music and things like that. People who just get the impression that they weren't really well versed in any books or music. The speaker asked them to name one British composer, and they said place over. And the meeting clashed into laughter, and so did the National Front idea. Just from that, I mean, going away from that meeting and thinking that the best possible way that you can confront ideas is to say to people like Patches. And I know that a lot of the various groups say you can ban Patches, so that doesn't mean. Surely the best way of doing it is to say, right, come along, we'll find there everyone in front of all the society. You tell us what your ideas are, we'll tell you what really our ideas are, and then we'll put it to the Democrats.
Yeah, can I just say something?
Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah.
Just sort of following on from that point there, something occurred to me that if you've got a march sort of like going down the street, say the National Front March, and you've got a counter demonstration like that, those two sets of marches may comprise, I don't know, say within London, they may comprise 1% of the population of London or something like that. Now, for all the rest of London who is watching, they don't feel strongly that, or feel too much apathy for either set of ideas to sort of be involved in that march. And in my experience, and this is just my experience, people are alienated. People are sort of polarised from what they view as two sets. I mean, really follows on from what you're saying, from two sets of people just shouting slogans at each other. You don't actually. I mean, we're not really. I mean, the fact that the fascists are in a minority, right? We do want to educate people. We do want fascists to be educated, not be fascists anymore. Obviously, that's true. But there's a whole vast number of people who aren't fascists who we want to convince. You know, and really, I mean, going and shouting slogans at this tiny minority of fascists who are prepared to walk along and speak isn't—it just doesn't convince the vast majority of people that you know. There's still people still harbour racist ideas. You know, speaking from my own experience, I've got relatives, I've got family who would no more march along the street sort of shouting fascist slogans than they would fly to the moon. But they're racists, every one of them, and they harbour racist attitudes. And I wouldn't convince them, I would never convince them by marching along the street and shouting slogans back, you know? And it's those sort of people that we want to convince, you know, ordinary working people who are just under a whole set of delusions about the position of society and the position of workers.
I'd just like to make a point to May now, and your friend Patrick Harrington was actually a member of the Young Communist League long before he actually joined the National Front. That's probably where he got his education from. The other point about ANL is that, and I was interested in ANL in 1978, and it was something that I went into, the background, their ideology, their funding, and it's a pretty well-known fact that ANL is actually funded by racists themselves. They're actually funded by the Jewish Board of Deputies, and in fact, after a year, they pulled the plug out and refused to bring more money on the basis that SWP had become largely anti-Semitic and anti-Zionist. And that's when it collapsed. And the SWP, who were the front organisation for ANL, actually lost more members. They used it as a membership drive, ploy. They actually lost more members at the end of it after the huge punch up illusion when Lev Peach was implicated by the SPG. Am I right?
No,
special trial. That's right. I was going to keep these there. the young Trots, the young Leninists, the SWP realised that A, fascism meant business, and B, state meant business, and that's why it collapsed. You know, really, if you're going to march on the streets to confront fascists or Nazis or the National Front or whoever, okay, either you've got to do it or you haven't. If you're going to do it, you've got to realise that when you do take on the fascists and you take on the state, you've got to have something to put in its place, and quite frankly, SWP and ANL didn't have it. You know, didn't put in this place, they would have just formed another fascist organisation, you might hear.
I'd like to make a point, particularly to the Ben, who asked what we in the Socialist Party do confront fascism. One of the most useful things I think we can do, and if this done by discussion of a rational kind with as many people as possible whenever the opportunity presents to them, one of the things we can do is to show how fascists, dangerous and harmful though their ideas are, though their people often are, they're not some kind of race apart. They're not something out there unconnected with anything else. The myth that the Communist Party propaganda of the 1930s built up that there's the left over here, the good people, and right over there, the right. Totally alien, different, thinking differently, behaving differently, and so on. That is a myth. The fascists of Italy and the Mussolini himself had been the editor of the Italian so-called Socialist Party, more like the British Labour Party, had been the editor of their daily paper, the equivalent of the editor of the Daily Herald in the 1920s, became the founder of the Italian fascist movement. I suppose there is some connection between, or similarity between that and the fact that Oswald Mosley was a disgruntled and dissatisfied member of the Labour Party, who was tipped at the time as being a future potential Labour Prime Minister. And when he left the Labour Party in
dissatisfaction. John Strachey associated with him. He was later to be a Labour Minister of War, if they can call it Ministry of Defence, who conducted the repression in Malaysia. But the notion of fascists and Nazis being something totally unconnected with people like us and our ideas or our illusions is very misleading. In fact, the Nazis and the fascists, where they were very significant in Italy and Spain and Germany and so on, drew upon ideas and attitudes that were very widespread in the general labour movement. In Spain, for example, it's not without and Italy, it's not without significance that years before the fascists as such came on the scene, anarchist views have been very persuasively and effectively put across. And the whole business of the parliamentary process and electoral rights and voting and so on was all a fraud and a sham and a delusion. There's no doubt about it, if people are convinced that it is a fraud and a sham and a delusion, then if somebody wants to take it away, they're not going to bother too much with that idea. What's a fraud or a sham and a delusion? You're no particular loss. So one can't separate the rise of a movement that said that people are slowed up and kept away from what's worthwhile, what's good, by democratic chicanery and all these slow processes of political democracy and so on. It's not too surprising if people have been persuaded that it's all a broad illusion, but it was taken away. I think there's a connection between them. Similarly, I will remind anybody who's terribly worried about the dangers of fascism to such an extent that you've got to go out and beat them up, that I remember when pillars of the left were prepared to share a political platform with fascists and quasi-fascists at the time of the common market argument before Britain went in. So passionately opposed to the common market were people. Somebody I have personally personally and had a personal regard for, I might say, Sidney Silverman, was prepared to stand on the pit in Trafalgar Square with Viscount Hinchinbrook. If you're looking at fascists, he would qualify fairly convincingly. But they shared a common platform against the common market. And it's not just a common platform. Clearly, they're appealing to a similar constituency. The kind of shock horror of all sorts of stolid British workers and the notion of being, you know, their Britishness being diluted by all these French and Germans and Danes and Italians, that's right. We're not a thousand miles away from the bread and butter of fascist rhetoric and propaganda and attitudes. And it was, as another contributor pointed out, a Labour government which did more in responding to widespread racist ideas of British workers by introducing racist immigration restrictions that in a way took the wind out of the fascist sails. You can say, they were pointed out rightly with Margaret Thatcher, to a large extent took the ground away from the National Front by making sounds which showed the National Front that they could really express themselves just effectively inside the Tory Party. But the Labour Party was also in the business of appealing to those sentiments. Well, in the case of the Labour Party, retaining people who would normally be voting Labour, but who would be attracted by these racist policies that the National Front and so on were offering. So, before anybody goes out to shoot anybody or thump anybody and so on, it's well worth, before a shot is fired and a punch is thrown, it's worth thinking about the background of these things and the illusions that are much wider than these particular specialist racist organisations encourage. And in the knowledge of that kind of thing, and the Socialist Party, I think, has done excellent work with all its limitations in encouraging people to think about these questions. I think if it does, if the Socialist Party does nothing more, it will suggest that a little less brawling, a little less shooting, a little more thinking and discussion of relating one event of the past to another, tying the two up, could be more fruitful.
With regards earlier on, I think what the speaker was saying earlier on about weak leader, weak leaders and weak followers, and she couldn't comprehend, I don't know when comprehend, but she couldn't see the parallels. You could have a strong follower, a strong leader, and a strong follower, because that concept just couldn't be worked out, because it seemed to be an impossible. If you look at sorts, for example, at certain anthropologists, for example, when they go meddling or interfering with other tribes, they would say, for example, as you know, there is a power figure, bloke who stands up one day and says something, and everyone sort of looks up, and everything's all right. And these anthropologists are certain, and in fact, absolutely certain, that without this bloke standing up, nothing would get done, which is a bad thing anyway, if nothing got done, but beside the point. But you know, they're convinced of it. If this bloke doesn't stand up, you know, nothing will get done in society. You know, this bloke is separate, and the rest of the body will just collapse, because without that person, anyone standing up, the rest of it will just cave in. Well, the simple answer is just to build it back up again, but that again is beside the point.